Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule. It's just whenever I finish a book, I just do the review and stick it up here on the podcast feed for everyone to download and listen to. This is actually my third review in 3 days, so I've got a little bit of spare time now and I can get through these reviews pretty quickly. So that means, of course, I haven't got any emails or any feedback since the last one, because I recorded it, uploaded it yesterday. Although I'm sure I will get an email from someone saying, hey, you missed off the theme music at the beginning of the podcast. That's true, I did. I just didn't. That's pretty much the only audio editing I ever do at the end of these podcasts is, put a little bit of compression to make sure the levels are correct on the whole thing, and then stick the theme music on the beginning, and I guess I just forgot that step yesterday, and I only noticed it when I clicked on it just to test it to see once it had actually uploaded, and there it was. So anyway, I'm going to get straight into today's book or books or series. Let me just jump straight into this. Back back in 1994. Harry Turtledove published, or he'd obviously already written, but he published a book called World War in the Balance. And maybe a year or two after that, I started reading them. They came into the into my local library, and I picked up the first book because it was, there was a big lizard on the front and a World War II tank or a plane or something. I can't remember exactly what it was. And I was like, hey, check it out. And I read the blurb on the back, and it said, World War II is underway. It's 1941 or 1942, and aliens invade. And I thought, well, that is perfect because I very much like science fiction. And back in the day, and even still to this day, I guess I'm a bit of a World War II history buff. I used to read lots of books. That's mostly because my father was an officer in the British Army, and he was always fascinated with all this kind of stuff. So, our house was always full of books about the Second World War, the First World War, actually just all kinds of different war books, lots of military books and things like that. So, when the book comes up, these two things together, I just think, well, this is obviously exactly what I want from science fiction, and I didn't really realize it at the time. That this was actually a genre, alternative history, where you just, change one event or one thing happens. And of course, I've mentioned this a few times recently on the podcast. I did, me and Juliana, we did our big discussion about Man in the High Castle and what was it? Yeah, the Watching Trees Grow by Peter F. Hamilton, which I mentioned in his short story collection, which I reviewed yesterday. That's also alternative history. But yeah, this was sort of my introduction to alternative history as well. When I was around about, I'd say, 15 or 16 years old when I first read this almost 20 years ago. Well, 15, 20 years ago. And of course it was a series. Of course, when I read the first book, I didn't realize it was a series, so it ended, and I was like, oh, there's still more to come. And then I realized, oh, it's not just World War, it's In the Balance. Then there's Tilting the Balance. Let me just quickly switch to the Wikipedia page here, which I have, which is going to be very handy, yes. So, World War In the Balance, 94. World War Tilting the Balance, 95. World War Upsetting the Balance, 1996. And World War Striking the Balance, 1996 as well. I guess they both had written them together and they came out both in 96. That's when I stopped reading. But apparently there was actually then another trilogy of books that take place afterwards called the Colonization books, and then another novel as well, which if I actually just go and look on the Harry Turtledove page, I'll probably be able to find it. Yeah, there's a Colonization trilogy, and then Homeward Bound, released in 2004. I never even really knew about that next trilogy for many years later, and by then I was like, oh, well, I'm not really so interested. I got all of my alternative history aliens invading during World War II fix with these four novels, and these are pretty chunky novels. The audiobooks, I listened to them years and years ago. I read them as paperbooks when they came out in the library in hardback, and then now these are maybe 24 hours worth or something, like 20 to 24 hours worth of audiobooks, audiobook to get through. So like a pretty decent sized novel, and there's four of these books. So I can't remember why we did it. Maybe it was just because we were talking about alternative history. I know I was talking to Jesse from the SFF Audio podcast about this series, and I thought, oh, I'll just give it a go. And I found it on Audible. And about half of the books that I listen to as audiobooks are novels that I've actually read before in the past as paper books. And then I go, well, I'll check out the... audiobooks are a fantastic way to reconsume books that you've already read before, and you want to read them again, but you don't want to put in so much effort into it, and that's what I do. So I've pretty much already set this up. The first book, World War in the Balance, is the one that I want to kind of mostly concentrate on in this review. And then once I've gone through all the stuff I like about this first book, I'll talk about actually what the series is like as a whole, and why I'm reviewing this after reading or listening to just two of the audiobooks in the series out of four, and why I'm not going to go on. So yeah, it's very a basic setup. Well, not a basic setup, but it's like one of those high concept kind of story that goes, which you can wrap up in a single sentence. You know, World War II is underway and aliens invade. What happens? And yeah, that's pretty much it. But there's a little bit more to it than that, because the aliens that come to Earth, they're not expecting, mechanized warfare, and, you know, an industrial revolution has already taken place, and, you know, they're already working on, you know, radars and radios and all these other kind of electronic parts of warfare as well, all these communication parts and things, and because the probes that the alien sent out 800 years ago found some guy in chainmail and another guy on a camel and somebody else with a bow and arrow, and they're like, hey, we can just go, we'll be able to conquer this planet no problem at all. So these lizard-like aliens come over, and they've already conquered two of the planets, so there's like an empire of three planets, and it's a very stable, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands year old empire. And they arrive on Earth, and they're like, wait a second, this picture of a guy on a horse, and this guy on a camel, and this guy with a bow and arrow, they're no longer really current. That's not what we're facing here. And they turn up and they're like, oh, well, what should we do? Well, we've got these, you know, we've got our own planes and our tanks and our bombs and our rockets and stuff. The main ship lord, the guy who's in charge of all of the, you know, the entire fleet, actually, is called the Fleet Lord. Fleet Lord Atvar. He's like, well, I guess we're just gonna have to do it anyway, because what can we do? We can't really just turn around and go home, because there's a whole other fleet behind us of the colonization fleet is behind us, and they're gonna arrive in 20 years' time. So we've got to get this war underway. We've got to get this conquest underway. And so they begin, and this it really begins one of my favorite memories of this book from when I read it so many years ago. The idea being that they look at this picture and they go, well, this is out of date. And then, of course, the second book in this series, Tilting the Balance, starts again with Atvar opening up that same file and looking at this video that this probe shot of these guys on a camel and a guy with a bow and arrow and a guy on a horse with some armor, and just looking at that going, well, if only we'd have seen this. And the idea being that this fleet lord, he's got like this nostalgia for what it used to be like to conquer planets in the past, and that's what they're expecting to go for. And so begins one of many, many, many good memories of this book. I had so many of these ideas. There's so many great scenes in this book. You know, just we're like opening up with that thing. It's such a great idea that these, you know, the fleet comes in and they look at this thing. And then down on Earth, there's lots of different human characters that you follow. And for example, there's a guy who's a medical student in Poland, in the Warsaw Ghetto. And he's walking along, and you know, he's in it. Talks about, you know, what the because the Holocaust is kind of underway. The pogroms against the Jews is going there, and they're starting to clear out some ghettos. Like it talks about, oh, there's, you know, now Lublin is Judenfrei, you know, free of Jews, and these other places, and Auschwitz is just starting up. So it goes into those kind of areas. And Moshe Russi says, he's going through, and he goes, God, if you're out there, give me a sign. And as he kind of like screams out to the heavens, or I don't think he does that, maybe he just says it in his own mind or like a prayer to God, God does give him a sign, and the aliens set off nuclear explosions above all of the cities that they're going to conquer, theoretically to knock out the electronic communications of the humans, even though this doesn't really work because human communication technology isn't based on transistors yet or any kind of delicate electronics that can be knocked out by these EMPs from the nuclear explosion. So it doesn't, that actually doesn't work. It doesn't knock out any of the radios or wireless kind of technology or that, but it does have a massive light in the sky, and Moshe Russi is like, yes, that's great, that is the sign. And of course the lizards come down and invade, and the Poles and the Jews get together with the lizards and kick out the Nazis from Warsaw and Poland, you know. So that's really great, and it's such a great scene. And there's many of these, but that of course brings up one of the main points of this, is like, okay, so that runs through the entire series, is the treatment of the Jews by the Nazis, and then the lizards come down, and are they going to treat humans better than the Nazis treat the Jews? In some cases, yes, but it's going to be still enslavement, and there's a major theme throughout it. And then you've got like these characters who are in the let me look at the list of characters here. Yeah, Flight Lieutenant George Bagnell, who is flying a Lancaster, and then the lizards' aircrafts come in and start knocking out the Lancasters out the way, and then of course the Lancasters no longer go and try and bomb Germany, but then they go and try and bomb the lizards, and an uneasy kind of peace sets up, like a ceasefire sets up between the Allies and the Axis powers, when they're just going, okay, well, yeah, you guys just do this, whatever, you guys can do whatever, we're gonna see if we can just sort out this lizard, and that's how, you know, that's how the kind of the politics and the warring factions kind of upset straight away with the lizards coming in. There's some other... Oh, yeah, and of course there's a one of my favourite scenes, which has always stuck in my head, is the idea of the railroad guns. There's the big Bertha gun, 200-ton gun or whatever it is, and they get it out there, and they're setting it up, and it's going to take weeks to build, and they're, you know, building and building and building, and then they get a one shot, boom, and they're like, yeah! And they knock out one of these alien spacecrafts that have landed in the steppes in the Ukraine or in Russia or wherever it is. And this scene really stuck with me, and as I was getting it, you know, as I was getting it there, I was like, okay, here it's coming, oh yes, this is the scene. And as I was like listening to the audiobook again, I was really, really happy. I had some really it was really great to reach these different scenes again. And I would keep going through it, but again, I don't just want to describe all of the cool scenes in this book. But for someone who was 15-year-old reading this for the first time, reading about these, you know, like tank commanders and Russian, you know, female Russian aircraft aces and and the development of the first atom bomb in the US. And all of these different characters, and the radar operators in the Royal Air Force down in Dover, down in Kent, all really, really great scenes. And for the first half of the book, what I find really great about World War in the balance is that, pretty much actually the first two thirds of the book, is that you never see things from the point of view of the leaders of the humans, but you don't see very much from the point of view of the everyday soldiers of the lizards, as they call themselves, the race. You see things from the point of view of a few of them. Like there's a tank driver that you call Usmak that you follow, and Tietz as well, who's one of these lizard jet fighter pilots. You follow those. But quite quickly, one of those is captured, and the other one is injured, and so they're kind of out of the action. So most of the action that you actually see on the ground is from the point of view of the humans who are directly opposing the lizards. But then from the lizard's point of view, you always see it from like the broader view. So you get like the overview of the war is always from the Fleet Lord, from Atvar's point of view. And he's like, oh, well, we're having trouble with this empire over there. We're having trouble with this things over there. And a lot of it is like, well, what's going on? How can they be fighting back? How can these humans be fighting back? They should have surrendered by now. And why is Italy going against us and then being for us and then against us? You know, the whole Italy switching sides, which is actually referenced in the Man in the High Castle, as well as how I'm not going to go into it now, but the idea of Italy switching sides comes in both of these things. And yeah, for most of the book, it's great. Like you get the two different sides of the war, the human side from the ground rather than from the leaders. And then from the lizard point of view, you get it from the leaders, and a little bit from the people on the ground, but that kind of like, you know, the everyday humans and everyday people and how their lives are affected by the war before the lizards come. And then how that changes after the lizards come, is really great. But then about the last third of the book, you do actually start meeting the human leaders as they start making alliances which mean anything, and you get, you know, Adolf Hitler meeting Molotov, and you get the, you know, Patton and Marshall meeting other people. You actually start seeing things more from the point of view. It's like as the humans get their acts together and try and work out like a united front against the lizards. When that starts happening, you actually meet the leaders, and Molotov who is a historical figure. It says here the head of the Soviet Union's foreign ministry. So he is he becomes like a viewpoint character, and which actually brings me onto these characters that you get, because some of them are fictional characters and others are historical characters. And when I first read this book, I wasn't quite sure what was going on. And now the second time I read this, as I was listening to the audiobook again, I was like, oh, that guy, yeah, Mordecai Anelowitz, who is the Polish. Like the leader of the Polish Jew or the Jewish and Polish what am I trying to say? Yeah, like the main guys who fights against the Nazis and then goes on and fights against the lizards and joins up with the lizards, but is always playing two sides. He's a historical figure. Molotov is a historical figure, and there's quite a few others, but there's only a few which are actually kind of like viewpoint characters that you go, okay, this is what this guy is thinking, this is what this guy is going to do, whereas most of the historical figures are like these secondary characters who you know, you just follow. They're kind of mentioned here and mentioned there, and then some of them come back again. But I actually really quite like most of the characters here in The Balance, in the first book, because they all seem to have something to do, even though it's not much. And sometimes you're like, okay, well, this is like a token Japanese person, and this is a token nice German person, and this is, you know, sometimes they just kind of fulfill the roles that you want to do. But each one of them is, it's like their human story, I wouldn't say is secondary to the war story, to the main like storyline of lizards invading Earth, but it seems to be that we're getting their personal stories to show the effect of the Russian, not the Russian, on the like what would be the effect of a Russian fighting alongside a Nazi, which comes out of you know, them getting a foe in common, you know, sort of like the enemy of my enemy is my friend, even though they used to be my enemy, and that kind of stuff. You know, if you understand what I'm saying, that the different conflicts between the characters and the different things that the characters go through is sort of like, you know, is a service to the main story. And I'll get onto what goes wrong in the second book later as I get onto that. But yeah, there is a lot of, you know, connection between them. For example, there's, you know, one guy will meet another, and then this, you know, and Moshe Russi is this Polish Jew. His the radar operator is David Goldfarb, who is his cousin, and his cousin works with this flight operator and this flight this flight lieutenant. He crashes his plane and meets up with this person, who also met up with that person. And there's this really cool interlinking of these different characters, especially in Europe, because, you know, this one person, there's this tank commander who goes up and meets with this person, and that person, and then he meets up with the pilot, and the pilot takes him there, and then the pilot also delivers somebody else over here, and then that and then other person meets Hitler, and all these, you know, it all kind of goes together. And then but then there's these connections with people in America. So you've got the European kind of arena, and then like the United States of America is also invaded, and you've got a whole series of characters over there. And one of the main groups of characters is which comes out is one of the things is that there's a baseball team which is traveling in a train, and the train is hit by right on the very first day. The lizards come down in the planes and shoot up this train, and a few of these guys are captured, and a few of them escape. So the ones who escape is a guy called Sam Yeager, and I can't remember the other guy's name. Maybe if I click across here, nope, I can't find the other guy's name. But he's actually one of my favourite characters. I should just pause and get his name, because he is one of my favourites. No. Let me have a look here. Nope, I can't remember his name, even though he's one of my favourite characters. But the leader, like the manager of this of this baseball team. And so this baseball team is another way to connect different characters, because one of them taken away, and he's put in space, and one of the characters from China, he's put with that, and it's sort of like a part of the experiments that the race is doing on the humans in zero gravity. And it's like, okay, well, how do you mate? So you get these weird people, like these weird scenes where they're kind of put in zero gravity and naked, and then just matched up with various people, and there's like some relationships develop there. And then Sam Yeager, he is actually a science fiction fan. He reads Astounding magazine and Amazing Stories, and when the lizards invade, when they actually capture some lizards, he's like, oh, I know about aliens, because I read science fiction. They're like, yep, you're the guy, so you go and look after these lizards. And he goes and meets up with these other guys, and then the leader, who is the old guy who used to fight, who previously he was in World War One in the trenches, his name will come back to me soon, I'm sure. Mac? I think it's Max's name. And so he does his thing. And so these three characters also connect up. And there's this other connection, which I did pick out years ago when I first read these books, but it's so much clearer when you listen to the audiobook, because one of the main characters in Europe is a tank commander in the German army who's fighting in Russia. And his name is Heinrich Jaeger. And then the guy who's the baseball player, one of these main characters, is called Sam Yeager. And, of course, they're spelled differently. Sam is Y-E-A-G-E-R. And then Heinrich Yeager is J-E, like the A umlaut, G-E-R. So, but when, of course, it's being, when actually doing it in the audiobook, sometimes it's a little bit confusing, because it's Yeager and Yeager, you know, spelt differently but pronounced the same. And even though I can't remember if they're ever said to be related, you actually realise that, oh, going back again, these guys obviously got, you know, great-great-great-grandparents in common. But when when Sam Yeager's great-great-grandparents went over to America, they just spelt it wrong, or, you know, they couldn't actually write down their own name, so they just said Yeager. Anyway, there's an announcement in my room here, so I'm going to pause. Okay, very short interruption there. Let me go back to this list of characters, because there's some pretty good stuff here. And also there is one of the major themes of this is that one guy called Jens Larsen, although when I was reading this book myself, I always thought of it as Jens Larsen, because he's got he's got like Scandinavian, I think Swedish, is it, or something like ancestry. But yeah, they call him Jens Larsen, and he leaves Chicago because he's working on the atomic bomb thing, and he leaves Chicago and then goes off on this mission to talk to, you know, to try and find the U.S. federal government and, you know, talk to them about saying yes, the atomic bomb project is very important. And then on the way back, he gets waylaid, and there's this weird love triangle that kind of sets up, and it's pretty interesting. You know, it's a pretty interesting thing, because it shows, like, okay, the war is getting in the way of people who even aren't soldiers, and even if you're not a soldier, you kind of get swept along into this thing, and it affects all walks of life and every part of your life. And and I really enjoyed that one. So what else do I need to say? I think that's all I want to say about the characters. Oh yeah, and there's quite a bit of sex in this. Again, when I was a 15-year-old boy reading this, I was like, "Ooh, a sex scene it is," and some of it's pretty sexy, and other parts are really good fun there. And I'm mentioning that for purposes of the second half of this review when I get into the next book here. But overall, I actually really enjoyed this, the different characters. And of course, the lizard characters, actually, again, there's a lot to do there. Their main role is to be, hey, we're lizards, and we're doing this, and we're different from humans, and we're going to find out about humans. And they're like, wait, you mate all the time? That's strange. Wait, you're technologically advanced really quickly because you fight all the time. Wait, what's going on? You're different from us in all this way. And so you do get the very, you know, you get all of those, like, hey, we can explore the human nature by looking at humans from the point of view of aliens and saying what's strange about that, you know, that observational science fictional kind of stuff about human stuff. So you do get a bit of that going back again. I do think the race is quite well developed, and there's some nice history there, even though sometimes it seems to be a little bit too convenient. It's like, oh, we need the race, the lizards race, to be like this, you know, just to be contrasting with humans. But otherwise, it's great. Moving on to, like, the science and technology, it's one of those things that I've mentioned before about, like, time travel and the Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court. The reason why that works is because it was written at the time when one person who went back in time would be able to, like, know enough about woodworking and metalworking and all these other kind of stuff. Like, one person can know the state of the art of chemistry and metallurgical things and other bits and pieces. You can get one kind of Renaissance man who is good enough to, who could go back 1,000 years and work with all that stuff. Whereas these days, you just wouldn't, because people these days are specialists, and you couldn't find one person, or it would be too unbelievable that one person could go back 1,000 years and be an expert in enough things to get by. So that's one of the things, and when you're matching up different technology in different time periods, and that's what you get here, really, that the only way to make alien invasion stories interesting is to kind of technological advancement in a way. It's like, okay, so if aliens are good enough to come all the way through space and arrive on Earth, there is absolutely no way they wouldn't be more technologically advanced than we are. And so you have to go, okay, so they have to have, like, a similar level of technology, but Earth technology is moving so quickly that when it gets the aliens invading, there's no way to do an invasion which is interesting, and that the humans can fight back in an interesting way. And I think that's one of the genius things behind The War of the Worlds, which is one of the first alien invasion stories. And you think it's strange that, like H.G. Wells, such a genius, that he picked out the main problem of this, is that doesn't matter what happens when two cultures collide. If two cultures, really truly different cultures, do collide, one of them is going to be overwhelming the other one in every way, you know, either in numbers or in technological advancements or in military means. And that's what you get here, that it literally has to be the worst timing ever for the aliens to arrive. Because if they had arrived, like, 2 years before, they would have been able to walk over, you know, because the world wouldn't have been, you know, geared up for massive war. And then if they'd arrived, like, 2 years later, the war would have been over, and, you know, the Cold War nations would already been developing jet planes and rockets and nuclear weapons, and nuclear stuff would be well underway, and and all of the issues with the with Germany would have been resolved or trying to be resolved. And so it's like, okay, this story only works if you pitch it directly there. So the level of technology of the aliens, even though they fly their planes down in from space and all that kind of stuff, it has to be pitched at that right level. So they're at around about, I'd say, like 1970s or 1980s level kind of war technology. And the humans have to catch up quite a bit. I don't want to go into all the individual little bits of technology, you know, like, what kind of things that, you know, the different tanks that the aliens have. But so much of the joy of this book is actually reading about, you know, Harry Turtledove obviously knows his stuff about Second World War military technology and tactics and all that, and the history. So it's really a joy to nerd out about, okay, and they put together this gun here, and this tank was bigger than that one, but this one ran on diesel, and this one ran on these ones ran on petrol, and this one had this much thick armor, and all those really nerdy details which appeal to me are great. And then you get all of those nerdy details with the alien technology as well, which is really great. I really enjoyed all of that. And what else do I normally talk about at this point? Yeah, sort of like the writing. I actually really enjoy the writing in this. Harry Turtledove, he does write these, they're quite chunky books. And the only thing that I'd want to say about this first book, the writing in this first book, is that there are a few points where it gets a little bit repetitive, and it's sort of like, oh yes, well, if only we'd have invaded 2 years ago, or, you know, if only these humans wouldn't have advanced this quite this much, and there is seems to be a little bit too much of, you know, the characters thinking the same things and going over the same thing. I'm just going to look at my iPhone. I'm doing this all without any notes, except for these ones on my iPhone. So, there's a funny line which is a reference to Slaughterhouse-Five by Kurt Vonnegut, where one of the characters goes, you know, when someone dies, he goes, so it goes. And I of course, last time I read this book, I hadn't read Slaughterhouse-Five, and now I have read it, and when he says, so it goes, I thought that was quite funny. And that line is actually put into the lips of an alien, into the lizard, even though lizards don't have lips. It's actually a lizard who does the so it goes thing. What else have I got here? Yeah, some picky things about the narration. Is it Celt or is it Celt? You know, is it Celtic or is it Celtic? Even though there's two pronunciations for different sports teams and things like that, I think he got mixed up once with, he said Celt, it's the Scots. In the north of English, they were the Celts. And I'm thinking, no, they're not the Celts, even though there was a Celtic. They're actually Celts. And another one as well, he mentions, I can't remember why, but I made a note of it, he said Antiochus, and it's not Antiochus, it's Antiochus, as far as I know, and maybe I got the wrong pronunciation there. Another note here, Italy switches sides, like in A Grasshopper Lies Heavy, which is the alternative history book, in the alternative history book of that one. So, that's all the notes I have there. So anyway, yeah, but the writing is pretty decent. You know, there's actually some really cool turns of phrases, none of which actually stick in my head. For this book, is very much like, you'll remember the characters, and you'll remember the really cool scenes of battles and what the humans do. You know, so I'm like, okay, again, so many of these great things stick in my brain, where they go, there's a dog approaching a lizard tank, and they're like, oh, it's only a dog, we don't need to shoot the dog, do we? No, we don't need to shoot the dog. And then like, wait a second, what's that on the dog's back? Holy shit, they put a bomb on the dog's back and send it over. And all the time the lizards are being caught out by the ingenuity of the humans. And what makes this book a real joy to read is that Harry Turtledove is going, hey, I've got a really good idea about what would happen if humans needed to defeat a technologically superior foe. They could do this. Yeah, and I'll do that. Oh, and they could also do this. Yeah, that would be good too. And they could do this. And he kind of just jams it all here into one book, which is great. Talking about the themes of this book, I could go into, you know, sort of like, oh, it's about politics and power and about, you know, switching sides in war and all that kind of stuff. But really, it's you know, that kind of stuff is very much on the surface of these books. You know, the whole idea of, like, the Jews, and I pretty much opened the review talking about this as well. Like, okay, if you're Polish and Jewish and you're in a ghetto, literally nothing could be worse than being under the Nazis in this situation. Nothing could be worse. And a lot of the book is kind of, for me, it's a bit strange that that is so clearly obvious that the Jews are better off under the lizards. But then once the lizards are using them as slaves, even though they're not wanting to slaughter all of the Jews in concentration camps, they still want to enslave the Jews. And then there's the quandary of these different Polish Jewish characters going, well, should we keep working with the lizards, like, against the rest of humanity? It's okay to work with the lizards against the Nazis, but now we're not just working with them against the Nazis, we're working with them against the British, against the Americans, against the, against the Chinese and Japanese and all these other different people around the world and what they can do, their quandary there. And I thought that was very interesting in the way that the Polish Jews are trying to trick the lizards and work with them, and then there's this whole, okay, what should we do, how much can we work with the Nazis, and I quite like that dynamic. That's one of the main dynamics that I actually really enjoyed in this book, and by the end of it, to see the Jewish characters. However, I do think one of the main problems is that the lizards just aren't nasty enough, in a way, because we have to identify with them as invaders as well. Like Atvar, the fleet lord, is quite a nice guy, and most of the lizards we meet, I mean, some of them are incompetent, some of them are again, one of the main subplots which I've not gone into is that there's a certain common food item which works as a drug for the lizards, and that becomes like a major subplot. So some of them are off their face on drugs, but none of them really seem to be malicious in the same way that when we get a conversation between Molotov and Hitler, and you see kind of Hitler's point of view of this, and you're like, wow, these guys are evil. These guys are like, there's something like super twisted here. And the same with some of the Japanese characters. You're just like, wow, I don't want these people to win. I want the lizards to beat the Germans. Sometimes with lizards, you go, well, I want the lizards to beat the Germans and the Japanese, but not the other guys. But of course, that's not what that whole dynamic is, what this book is about. Because then, of course, you meet the Germans, and some of the Germans are quite nice as well. And like, oh, this guy, when he finds out about the Holocaust, when he stops turning a blind eye to it, of course, he has to work with the Polish Jews. And yeah, there's some. Great writing there of these different characters trying to come to terms with it. And finally, there is this interesting the character of I think his name's Mac. Yeah, the old guy who runs the baseball team, the minor league baseball team. He's this like southern hick who throughout this thing is sort of like, oh, you're a woman, get back to the kitchen. And he's like, oh, women, okay, well, I guess women can be good for something, except that. And then he meets a black man, and he's like, hey, boy, and the black man's like, don't call me boy, hey, son, whatever, and he has to come to terms with, like, okay, the lizards are invaded, what do you do now when looking at the rest of humanity? Are you going to be a white, southern racist hick, or are you going to, it's sort of like the 1960s, like and all the human rights and all that kind of revolution is kind of accelerated forward, because you've just got to realize that, hey, we need everyone, we need all humans to come together in this way. In his character, you see those issues through his eyes. So, which brings me to the end of this. I really, really enjoyed World War in the Balance. I think it is a very good book. That I think it's really, like, if you like alien invasions, if you like aliens, if you like World War II, if you like any kind of military science fiction and all that kind of stuff, it really is worth reading. And I'm going to give it 4 stars because it is, it's one of those books where I was thinking, well, I read this when I was 15 and I'm going to read it again now. And I bet you anything it doesn't hold up, because this happens so often with these times. I just go, oh, I really enjoyed this when I was 12. And then I read it again and go, oh, oh, that's actually really tedious to get through, and the writing is really clunky, and the characters are really flat, and it's way more sexist and racist than I remember, but I didn't notice it when I was 13 years old. But this book, it actually really does hold up. It's a very good book, and I do recommend it to everyone. So I'm going to give it 4 stars. And also, if you want to help out the SFBRP, and if you want to listen to this audiobook for free, you can sign up to audibletrial.com/SFBRP, and there you can sign up for a free trial. You can select this one as your free audiobook that you can sign up, and you'll have a month to listen to it, and you'll get through it no problem in a month. And then if you want to continue on, you can either get one book per month afterwards or 2 books per month, depending which account you get, a platinum account or a gold account. I have the platinum one. I get 2 audiobooks a month. And it's totally worth it. It's really a great way, like I said before, it's a really great way to reread books which you otherwise wouldn't have time or the motivation to reread. But if you want to check out something that you've not read for 20 years, it's probably going to be there on audible.com. So check it out, audibletrial.com/SFBRP, to start your free Audible trial. Which brings me to the qualification of this World War series. And I've mentioned this setting up for this last 10 minutes of this review, or hopefully about 10 minutes of this review. I had loads of really, really good memories. So many memorable characters, so many great character moments, so many great scenes, as I said, in battle and in the invasion, all this kind of stuff. And there was loads and loads of, you know, really good, like, memorable scenes. And I read all 4 of these books in this series back in the day, probably, you know, finishing up quite soon after they were all out, I'm guessing. I you know, remembering back to where I was living at the time and which library I got them, I know that I finished these books, you know, by 1998 or 99, I guess, is when I actually finished these books as they were coming out. Yeah, so I had lots and lots of scenes in my mind that I remembered from this book. And as I was listening to this first audiobook in The Balance, World War in The Balance, the first book, like, all of those scenes, except maybe 3 or 4, like, you know, of the dozens and dozens of really memorable scenes, they were all in this first book. And I got to the end, I was like, wow, there's another 3 books of the same length in this series. And I only remember, like, 3 or 4 things that happen in the rest of these books. So I was like, well, what can be there? And I remember, you know, at the time thinking, oh, well, you know, it starts off strong, but then you kind of get the, what I call the sequel fatigue or sequelitis or whatever you call it, when you read the next book and you're just like, oh, it wasn't as good as the next one. And then you keep reading until you get those diminishing returns. So I thought, well, instead of just reviewing, like reading this one book and then reviewing it and then reading the next in the series, what I'll do is I'll just keep listening to the series on audiobook until I get to a point where, you know, the returns have diminished enough. And so I used another Audible credit and got the next book in the series, Tilting the Balance, and started listening to it, and it picked up, and it was quite redundant at the beginning because, of course, like, it doesn't, you know, when these books were written, they were coming out a year apart, and when you write these books, some people might pick up the book at book 2 and they've not read book 1 for many years, and you need to kind of, like, catch up on the characters. So each time the character was mentioned, it was like, yes, and then here's Sam Yeager in the previous book, he did this and did this and did this, and he was thinking this, and he liked this, and you think, you know, okay, that's great. And then you know, that you get to you, and the next character comes along, and yes, and this is great, and you go, yes, okay, I read that in the last book. But of course you're going to spend, like, the first few chapters catching up on all of the characters and what they're doing now, and, you know, picking them up and saying what they've done since the last book and things. But then the redundancy and the repetitiveness of these ideas continued throughout the entirety of the second book, to the point where, like you say, there was 2 memorable scenes, and the 2 memorable scenes was, one, the one of the lizard characters talking to one of the baseball players going, how do you hit a round ball with a round bat? And he's like, well, it takes practice. And that's one of the 2 scenes I actually remember from the second book. The other one is one of the Jewish characters going through Poland and trying to pass as a Catholic and going into a house, and there's the daughter there, and he's like, oh no, the daughter wants to get in bed with me, but I can't because I don't have a foreskin. She'll work out that I'm a Jew straight away. And then the father the next day going, hey, if you want to pass as a Catholic, you need to learn how to cross yourself at the right time and in a more fluid motion, and, you know, you can't be surprised when we serve pork, and you've got to, you know, these different different things. And there's that scene actually is really good. And his and this one character, this Polish was Anwelowitz, no, I can't even remember his name now. Mordecai Anwelowitz. And his story and what he gets up to is interesting in the second book. And so I kind of remembered what he did, and there was like one or two other bits. Oh yeah, and one of the main action sequences at the end of this book takes place in the Croatian city of Split, and in Diocletian's palace there. And after I'd read this book years and years ago, but then a few years, because I work on cruise ships, and if you go to Croatia, you can go either to Dubrovnik or Split on a cruise ship, and I went there. And when I was there, I was like, oh, I remember this place. I remember these walls, because this was the place where the action happened at the end of Tilting the Balance. Or, you know, I remembered it was in these World War books at some point where that happened. So it came back to me when I visited the place where the action scene, I was walking around going, oh, that's where they came through this door and did that kind of stuff. So there was like three memorable things. But the rest of the book is just, it's super repetitive and just not very, and it's not just like repetitive, like, oh, and then we're doing this, and then, oh yes, of course, well, if we had the right guns, we'd be able to do this, said the lizards. And it's like they're slowly running out of ammunition, and like there's scene after scene going, but we need more rockets, but we don't have enough rockets, but we need more rockets, but we don't have enough rockets, well, if only these Jews weren't so pesky. Yeah. And then like two chapters later, well, if only these Jews weren't so pesky. Then another three chapters later, well, if only these Jews weren't so pesky. And you're like, well, these same characters have had these same thoughts. Why do we need them yet again? And it gets a bit like, you know, like they've got a character here and a character over there, and they need to do something with these characters, but we've got another three books to fill, another four books to fill. And it kind of felt a little bit like, you know, the Game of Thrones. I've only read the first book in that series, but it felt a bit like, okay, well, we've got this character and we need them to do something all this time. So they're going to go from there to there, and then they're going to go from there back again, and then back the other way again, and then they're going to go north and they're going to south. And it felt like these characters are being moved around quite a bit without them actually like achieving much, except that, you know, the book needs to take until the end of the Second World War, and he's got three books to fill to get to do this, so he's got to just move the characters around. And again, it's not just sort of like this kind of feels repetitive, getting again, once again, she got into her plane and she flew here, and she knows that, and you can't fly very high, because if you fly too high, the aliens will see you, and it's good job that her aircraft was made out of, you know, string and canvas and wood rather than aluminium, because it didn't show up on the radar. It's like, how many times do you have to tell me that this little aircraft is the best again? We know that. I've read a whole book where she got through because she had a little airplane and, you know, does the same airplane now. You don't need to keep telling me the same thing. And the, you know, tank commander, oh well, if only we had a tank which was better. It's like, yes, you described what was why the tanks were better and all the tactics, and instead of using this knowledge, I mean, there is one or two pretty cool tank battles in this as well, but it doesn't have that same freshness, because it's like, yeah, we had a tank battle. Why instead of in this new tank battle, why are you going over all the same details over and over again and saying, oh, this is what the lizards tanks are like, and this is what the human tanks are like, and now we're going to do this. And I was like, yeah, you've told us all of that. Let's get through some of this action. And again, going around North America, it's like, okay, and this town has been smashed to bits, and it's really, and this town has been smashed to bits. And it's like, yeah, stop describing the same things over and over. And Mutt is his name, not Mac. Mutt. I've called him Mac up until now. Mutt. And there's this one character called Mutt who is comes under fire, you know, quite a bit. And I think in two separate chapters he's under artillery attack, and he's in a trench, and it says, and it picked him up and slammed him as though he was in a ring with a professional wrestler or something like that, as though he's been pile-drived or slammed to the canvas by a professional wrestler. And then a few chapters later it's like, yes, and then he was slammed down as though he was in a ring with a professional wrestler. It's like, you've just used that analogy or simile or whatever it is. You can't just do it again. Or maybe you can just do it again, but just do it, you know, why just write that same line over again? Another thing that's super repetitive is the sex scenes. Like I said before, it's like, okay, we had a sex scene in the first book, and it meant something because it was like the development of a development of the character, and it was a reaction to something or because of something the aliens were doing. It was like, okay, this is impact, this has got something to do with the overall story. We're going to do this. And in this, it's sort of like, and then he hovered himself over her and did this or whatever. And then afterwards, when they were like this, and it's like, well, how many times do we have to read later or a while later, they were laying together sweaty? It's like, yeah, okay, we've had the sex scenes, like in the first book we had like four or five in 24 hours of audiobook listening, or 500 pages, you can get through it because they meant something. In this, it was just like time and time again, it's just like, stop with the sex scenes. They're not even sexy because you're just writing the same thing over. We're seeing the same two people have sex just all the time. It's just not very interesting. It's not hot or sexy. And if you're going to do a sex scene, you've got to, at least try and make it a bit sexy. Again, maybe 16-year-old Luke who read this, or 17-year-old or whatever, was like, oh yeah, more sex. Woo, why not? Appealing to the nerd. It's like, yes, and you too, as a nerd, maybe one day you'll have sex this regularly. It's like, yeah, thanks. And what else was the repetitive thing it was in my brain. I should have made some notes other than this. Let me quickly look at my iPhone to see the notes in the... here it is. Slammed like a ring with a pro wrestler. And there's another thing as well, where in this situation, the sharing resources, and he says, oh, it maybe like Solomon, we should cut the baby in half. And I'm like, you did that in the first book. You talked about Solomon cutting the baby in half in the first book, and now you're just doing it again. Why do we need to see that? And again, it's like this character is like, oh, and you took a trip across the United States on a bicycle. And guess what? In this book, you're going to take a trip across the United States on a bicycle. Oh, come on. So yeah, just repetitive in every way. And what was that? Oh yeah, it was Mutt. That's what I was going to talk about. The other repetitive thing is in the first book, Mutt was like, okay, and now women. Ah, okay, well, maybe women are humans after all. And black people. Oh, maybe black people are humans after all. I'm Southern racist and things like that. And in this book, they're like, well, Mutt has kind of seen the worth in women. He's seen the worth in black people. What else can we do? And then so he meets his character and kind of gets him well. And then it takes him half the book to go, oh wait, the reason why you won't kiss me back and have sex with me is because you're a lesbian. And she's like, I don't want to talk about it. It's like, yeah, you're one of those lesbo, in his Southern American accent, which I'm terrible at accents. And you're just like, ah, like, why? It's like his character is a character which has to slowly turn from a Southern hick to sort of realize the common shared humanity with all. And in the first book, it was like, oh, okay, this kind of makes sense. Even if it was quite blatant. In the second book, in Tilting the Balance, it's like forced into the story. You're just like, okay, sure, he could meet a lesbian and have this adventure, in trenches and with this lesbian nurse. But it just felt like, he needs another social group. He needs another minority to come to realize the good in these people or whatever. It just felt in this book very forced. And time again, we meet these characters. And also, it gets to the point where you're like, well, in the first book, you kind of go, these characters are important. Well, not important. We're following these characters because these are the characters who, like, survive through to the end of the war. Or, it's one of those things. It's like, well, you get to these disaster movies. It's like, well, why are we following these people? It's like, well, these people are the important people. They look like normal people, but in any big event, there will be coincidences which bring people together. There'll be some people who die and some people survive, but you're not going to just follow the random people. You're going to follow the people who turn out to be quite important or who do have these connections and do have some, things as they go through. And that's what you kind of feel like in the first book. And there's some characters don't make it to the end of the first book, and there's this one character who dies quite near the end, and you're like, woohoo! And I don't want to give it away too much about who dies. There's some good character moments, and you actually care who lives and dies, and you care that some of these these husband and wife have been separated, and you care that these other two people find each other, and you care that this radar operator who doesn't get the girl becomes he goes up in a plane. And as soon as he goes up in a plane, they're like, oh, now you can get the girl. It's like, yeah, because I've been up in the plane. It's like, oh, that's why the pilots get the... there's all these great character moments. And in the second book, all of that just kind of gets chucked out because these characters, they suddenly like connected in ways which it just doesn't feel organic. It doesn't feel real anymore. It's like Harry Turtledove had all these great ideas and put them into the first book, and in the second book was like, well, I've got to move these pieces around. It's like a chess piece. I've got to move that person there, and I've got to do this and got to do that. But it never felt like the connections between the characters never felt organic. And also in the first book, he had this really great way. And I think I mentioned it in a review a while ago, I can't remember which book it was, about introducing characters who later turn out to be important characters. Oh yeah, it was in Mogworld, and also I talked about it in Neuromancer, where you get a character who turns up, and they're not very interesting, and you don't really pay that much attention to them, they're just like a minor character, and then they turn out to be a really important character, and you're like, that guy is an important character. Oh, I thought he was just like a minor supporting character who was just there for that one scene, and then he comes back and he's super important. What I really liked about the first book is that happened, it's like the opposite way around. This is a great example of you read a book and you're following one viewpoint character. And this, you know, so if, as an example, you're following Sam Yeager in America, and you think, well, the main characters that we're going to follow, and he gets picked up, you know, he escapes, and his other buddy is taken and abducted by, this other ball player is abducted by the aliens, and you think, well, these two guys are the guys that we're going to follow, but then you're like, yeah, but their boss, the guy who used to be in World War One, Mutt, he's like a really great character, and you're like, oh, I hope Mutt sticks around, I hope he doesn't die, and then halfway through the book, you suddenly start getting like stories from the point of view of Mutt, and you're like, oh, that's great, because Mutt was one of my favorite characters, and I thought he was just going to be a minor character, and now he's become a viewpoint character, and we're going to spend time with him, and he's going to go off and have adventures independently of these other guys, and you're like, oh, that's really great, I'm really pleased about that. And it's the same when let me just quickly look back on this to check the Jens Larsen. He goes over to talk to the I'd say go to the Pentagon. Of course, the Pentagon wasn't around, but he goes over to talk to the military command, and we meet this character called Colonel Leslie Groves, and of course at the time he's just introduced, and he's this guy, you know, and he's got this guy, and he's picking up the telephone, and he's talking over here, and he's talking then, and you're like, wow, this guy seems to have his head screwed on, like. This guy, he, even though he's a minor character, he felt like he felt lived in, he felt important, and of course it turns out he's actually a historical character, and you're just like, oh man, he was really great. I wish, you know, it would be great to spend more time with him. And then later on, you do spend more time with him. He goes and meets some, you know, submarine over here and pick this, and he becomes a very important figure throughout the rest of the book. But that's the kind of writing that I like. Oh yeah, and there's Yi Min as well. Lu Han and Yi Min. You start off with Lu Han, who is a Chinese housewife. I didn't mention her so much earlier. She gets abducted and taken up into orbit. Also Yi Min, who is someone who she knew from her village. And you're like, well, Yi Min, he's a bit, you know, he's an interesting character. He's a bit of a bad guy, but he works with the lizards because, you know, he's Chinese. And after the Japanese, it's like, oh, the lizards are a step up. Well, yeah, we can work with these. And you're like, well, he's really interesting. And then when Lu Han and Yi Min get split apart, you're like, oh, well, it's a pity we won't get any Yi Min anymore. And then later on in the book, you start following him and you're like, oh, yeah, this is great. So that's what I really liked about the first book, and that's what I think is actually a sign of really great writing, when you get characters where you're just like, oh man, I wish I could spend more time with this minor character, and then when he then rewards you by spending time with that character. And in the second book, Tilting the Balance, I never felt that a time, like any minor character who came in, I was like, well, I know what's going to happen with this character. This character is just going to have to be killed off by the end to teach this other character a lesson, or to make this other thing go. And then when it gets to the end of the book, you're just like, oh yeah, that is what happened. Oh, well, could have done better there. And there's another character introduced. I'm just like, well, you're introducing this character just for this other character have someone to have sex with. And it just never really, the same kind of spark just wasn't there. So I decided, once I got to the end of Tilting the Balance, that I'm not going to continue reading it, because also I know how this series ends. You know, I know what happens at the end of, Upsetting the Balance and then Striking the Balance, I think it is. Let me have a look here. Yeah, Striking the Balance. I know what happens at the end of Striking the Balance, so I'm definitely not going to read now Upsetting the Balance and Striking the Balance. What I might do is just check out the Wikipedia pages for them, just to catch up with the story. But I might then check out the next book in the series, which is which is the, let me have a look here, what's it called? Yeah, the Colonization trilogy. I'm going to check if they're on Audible, or maybe just find it somewhere. I'm sure I can find the book or an ebook or something like that. And I might actually check out that trilogy to see what happens after, because then I'm striking into new territory that I've not read before. Or maybe I'll just check out some other of Harry Turtledove's books, because I know some of his other alternative history is well regarded. Although I'm not really against, one of those weird things is, like, is alternative history, is that really science fiction? I think you do need other kind of science fiction elements in there. Otherwise, it's, I don't know, it's a conversation for some other time. And I'm sure lots of other people have had this conversation before. But this World War series is very much science fiction because of the alien invasion. So it fits into this podcast very well. So if I was to give Tilting the Balance a star rating, which I will, I'd give it like 2 stars. But overall, I don't think this is a very good series. I think the first book, In the Balance, World War In the Balance, is very good, worth reading. But unless you really want to slog through it, literally, I can remember 2 things. Like, of all of the things that I remember from this series, all of them were there in World War In the Balance, except maybe 4. 3 of those 4 were in Tilting the Balance, and the only thing that I remember, literally one of the only things that I remember now, except for the overall story and kind of overall what happens, but specific scenes or specific lines, there's one where Winston Churchill says, "Lizards, if you invade England, we're going to use a weapon on you which nobody else has used so far." And you're like, what's this? And of course, I remember at the time, it's like, gas! It's gas! Because in the First World War, they used gas, and in the Second World War, they didn't use gas because it was, you know, it was, it was like, not against the Geneva Conventions or whatever it was, but it wasn't tactically, it wasn't really worth doing because the enemy was moving too much. I can't, off the top of my head, I can't remember it now, but I was realizing, they're going to gas out the lizards. And of course, the lizards invade England, and you know what happens? They start using the gas, and the lizards are like, holy shit, why? What? Where did this come from? So that's the only thing that I remember literally half of the books in this series. I only have like one memory or one scene that I remember clearly from them. So I'm just not going to slog through them. I'm going to skip them. So I'd give Tilting the Balance 2 stars. And overall, if I was going to, you know, rate the entire series, which is pretty difficult, I'd actually give it quite a low rating because the first book is brought down. But I still do recommend In the Balance. I think it is a really interesting and book well worth reading. So the podcast, this podcast, I'm only going to title World War In the Balance, and it'll have a 4-star rating there on the episode lists page on sfbrp.com. But it does come with the non-recommendation or the anti-recommendation to continue this series, because I don't think it's worth it. And the story that plays out throughout 4 books, I don't really think it's worth, I don't think it's worth slogging through another 3 books just to find out what happens. It's probably just best to kind of understand that things don't move on massively from the first book through to the end of the 4th book in the series in a way that's satisfying. Of course, when I was reading it when it came out, I didn't know that, and now this is the 2nd time through, I know what's happening, so I'm just not going to bother. So, I think that's about it. I do recommend the first book. You can email me, luke@juggler.net, if you've got any feedback that you want me to reply to specifically, because I do reply to every single email that I get, especially if there's a question in there. If you want to recommend a book to me, you can do that by email, or you can do that via goodreads.com. You can become my friend on goodreads.com and suggest books to me there. And you can also comment on this review by going to the Goodreads page for this review. There's obviously a link right there in the blog post on SFBRP, and you'll be able to find it. Another great thing you can do on goodreads.com is rate your book. So what happens if I read a book that you've rated and reviewed? I can see your opinions on it right there before I do my review, or after I do my review. Of course, I don't actually have the Goodreads page open for this Harry Turtledove book or series here, so I'm not going to do that this time. And the other thing, of course, you can get in contact with other SFBRP listeners if you join the SFBRP listener group on goodreads.com, and you can, you know, create a thread there in the forum and discuss this book or anything like that. You can, if you want, you can start a discussion thread like, is alternative history really science fiction or is it not? Whatever. Otherwise, follow me on Twitter. I'm at Luke Burge. And also, as I said before, I said in the last podcast, if you want to check out previous books and you don't want to look through the iTunes feed on the blog, of course you can go to the episode list page, go to sfbrp.com, click on episode list, and you can see all of the episodes in order, all of the books that reviewed, like listed by stars or star ratings or by authors or by episodes and stuff like that. It's a good resource there. I've not updated the last few books, but of course that those lists will be updated once I get home from this work trip with these last few reviews. It does it automatically, but I've got the internet on cruise ships isn't that good, let me put it that way. So yeah, that's it for now. Thanks a lot for listening, and I'll catch you next time.